Sergio!
Hello and welcome to episode 56 of Major Revisions, a podcast from three early career ecologists. My name is Jeff Atkins, and I hail from Wahlberg, North Carolina. Joining me is John Walter from Westchester, PA, and Grace Wilkinson from...
Vadnais Heights.
I knew it looked French, but it was going to be more westernized. Big fan of the Midwest for all this reason. On this episode in This Week in Ecology, we're going to take a deep breath of the warm springtime air that we have, and we're going to bring you a roundup of some of our favorite conversations and topics and trends that have been happening, particularly online recently. But God, in the last week, it feels like everything's just kind of really...
Yeah, people are spring cleaning their opinions on Twitter right now.
Dude, we got everything. We're going to be talking about diversifying your collaborators, a crazy new poster template that I'm not a fan of, real ecosystems versus, you know, this. What is a real ecosystem? A couple of long threads on culture, and casually dropping some info and job talks, and then also a remarkably terrible article from the Chronicle of Higher Ed. But I want to start off tonight, Grace, by asking you, since you told me since it hit 70 Fahrenheit in Iowa today that it's...
That's right. We popped open the rosé today because it is finally spring.
Okay, so rosé is at 70 Fahrenheit. Okay, explain to me the alcohol drink thermometer.
Right, well, I think there's kind of a hysteresis, because as you're approaching 70, you're more willing to take on things like rosé and the other warm weather drinks, you know, like a gin and tonic is perfect. Once the thermometer hits 85 for the first time in Iowa, we are on the porch sipping G&Ts. But on the way back down in the fall... you know, once you're getting below 70, that's when we start breaking out the heavy reds. So I just really think that there's... And it's not like I've been drinking heavy reds up until this time. So there's a real hysteresis in the thermometer.
Interesting. Okay, so really it's just heavy red season. And then there's like the growing season is punctuated by a rosé uptick, a G&T kind of level. Is there like a brief foray back into rosé very quickly in the fall and then straight to reds? Or is there... Do you ever hit like Chablis or Chardonnay or anything? This is the extent of my wine knowledge.
You know, that's a good question. I do not drink Chardonnays, but that's because I have a thing about popcorn in my mouth while I'm drinking wine. I just don't like that butteriness. It's no good. But
I don't really believe that white wine is a thing.
Oh my.
It's either red or rosé, or it doesn't... It's not real.
Our first hot take of the night: white wine. White wine sucks. Okay.
Super cultured.
So, rosé from a bag is my favorite rosé.
I do have to mention though, all time of the year is margarita time of the year. In this household, Grace. Yeah. Okay, just making sure we're clear.
I want to put out a thing for this BuzzFeed video that I watched the other day. I don't know why we've been watching these BuzzFeed videos, but like the Try Guys or whatever, and they did one where they did alcoholic drinks from every 50 state, or every one of the 50 states, and I forget which state it is, but legitimately, like, boxed wine is like the state drink. I think it's like Delaware or something. It's somewhere that, like, you think it would be. Like, when you hear it, you're like, yeah, that makes sense.
What about Boone's Farm? Is that the state drink of any state?
Spirit-wise, in New Jersey. You know, that's fine. All right, so leading off, diversifying your collaborators. So this came, I think, originally from a thread from Kim Novick, right? And then I think Ben von Lamberty also posted some analysis based on this. But this is looking at showing the relationship between the number of authors on a paper and the number of women. And it's not great, I believe, isn't it? I feel like the number was 23%, but I should click on the link and before I just look at that. Oh, no, this is... Yeah, she did like the multi... like odds ratios of, you know, number of female authors, number of one female author, and it comes out not great, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, somewhere in like the low 20s to have one female author.
And so that you shared this with us on the Slack, and it got us kind of thinking and looking back at our own publication history, and sort of calculating those stats. So what's the percent of papers that you all have been on where women have been dominant? So in other words, they're equal to or greater than 50% of the co-authors.
6% if I round up.
I got 11% if I round down. But can I also point out, yeah, a caveat to that? It's a two-author paper, so there's technically only one woman on it.
I counted that for one of mine.
Okay,
I'm at 28.5%, but I always contribute, right? So that's a little unfair.
Okay, but percent with only one woman.
I'm at 57%. I am that woman. On 57% of the papers I have published, I am the sole female author.
I have 56.
That is really impressive.
That's a function of the fact that I think I have a half to a third the number of papers Grace has. So really, that's all that is.
How about you, John?
Oh, I have a 28%.
That's better than six?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it might be better than the field average, but let's not use that as a measuring stick, because it's a shitty measuring stick.
Yeah. All right, percent with no women. Well, I guess, Grace, you're out of this one, technically. Mine's 33%, so.
Yeah, mine's 50%.
I have one paper that's eight authors, and there's not a single one.
Oh, I call those manuscripts.
Yeah, it's
with a capital M-A-N.
Yes.
It's not a great look, admittedly.
A great look. But obviously, I think we were all a little bit startled by calculating these. It was a good exercise, and this is even just one dimension of diversity, right? But how have these stats, we were talking about it first and just like, oh, in the past couple of years, if you look at it, this is what it looks like, and it, you know, this, our stats are better. So how have these changed over your careers? Have they improved for all of you, or like, what was the control over that, do you think?
I think all of us going through the same graduate program was the function of breaking out of that graduate program, because there were limited opportunities from faculty to pull from. There was effectively two, and then one of them was vastly outside of the area that any of us worked in, and then, you know, the other one, she was on sabbatical a lot and just wasn't like really available at the time when we were in graduate school, so there was like not, you know, within our department that opportunity, which is a whole nother issue. Like, there obviously, right, should have been, right? There's you know, but I think for us, it was kind of limiting. So I think, you know, for mine, definitely like explodes like after, you know, graduate papers. Like, the three that I have that have no women on them are three from my dissertation. And, you know, my dissertation committee was three guys, and my outside person was female, but she was from engineering. It was there just more as like a dean's rep, right? So she's not actually like, she wasn't a collaborator on projects. So it was more like expanding out. And once, you know, leaving graduate school, you know, there's, you know, I have papers that have multiple women on them, but a lot of them are typically the same two who appear on multiple papers. And then, you know, some other collaborators just kind of here or there, but there are two, you know, who are on multiple papers. So mine kind of goes from that. John, what about you?
You know, similar story here. You know, I like, especially for my PhD work, you know, worked in an area where, you know, women are definitely, I think, underrepresented, even, you know, relative to other areas of ecology. You know, is, you know, basically built off of my, you know, my advisor's network of collaborators, which was predominantly male. You know, those are the people who are co-authors on my papers. You know, my first female co-authors are all students.
Yeah.
You know, undergraduate students who I mentored, or were mentored primarily by other people that I co-authored with. And it's really only more recently in my career that I've been collaborating with women who are at the same career stage or, you know, a more advanced career stage than me. And, you know, I think that that's, you know, I think it's hard because a lot of your early experiences are shaped by your advisors and who they collaborate with. And in some, like in some respects, it's statistically more likely that they're going to mostly have male co-authors and stuff like that. But, yeah, you know, if you looked at, you know, my most recent papers, my papers that are in prep and in review, there's a lot more gender balance.
Yeah. You know, you made a really good point too about the, I was thinking about the other women that I've been co-authors with, and they have by and large been students or trainees. So either fellow graduate students at the time or undergraduate trainees. And, that I think I only have one instance with someone who is at a career stage above mine. And that is very much shaped, you're right, by that early network that you're plugged into. It can really influence that.
So, I mean, this kind of brings up the question, like, you know, how much, you know, so certainly that there's an issue of, you know, possibly, you know, women and minorities not receiving the credit that they deserve, for their contributions to work. And that's a whole other ball of wax. But, you know, just thinking about the way that we, you know, seek out collaborations, do you think that this is something that we should be cognizant of? Do you think we should be, intentionally trying to collaborate with, you know, scientists who are, you know, women or minoritized in other ways?
Yeah, I think if you can, absolutely.
Yeah. You definitely should diversify.
So what would be some strategies to go about doing that? Would that be making some real concerted efforts when you're at meetings and when you're reading papers to reach out to people?
I think so.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think looking around to when let me make a statement we all can agree with.
I just say like I like, do I have a thoughtful like no, you're right. This is like yeah. You should.
No, I mean so just you know, playing devil's advocate for a moment, you know, there's also a lot of evidence that you know, there are large burdens that fall on, you know, female and minority scientists to, you know, be the representative of, you know, all women or, you know, all, LGBT people or, you know, whatever. And so they get tapped for, a disproportionate amount of service responsibilities. You know, obviously, like, the benefits of collaboration accrue differently to people's careers than the benefits of, you know, serving on 16 different university committees. But, you know, do we run the risk of having something like that happen if everyone, in a well-intentioned way, wants to collaborate with a select number of female or minority scientists?
Okay, so my real thought on this is a symptom of a larger problem, right? You know, it's a bad analogy, but I think of this is going to come up later. We talk about dropping your kids, right? Like I think of my kids having to deal with you know, test scores and stuff in school. The test scores are what they're evaluated on. So they a lot of times will focus on raising the test scores by having the students practice the test more and take away from time that they could be learning or doing other things, right? So they're losing the learning because they're focusing on the outcome. We need to address the issues. The issues being, of course, you know, retention, creating environments that are supportive of diversities in all ways, right? Like, if you create that environment, then the papered citation thing will change too, right? I mean, obviously there's a covariance here based on, like we said earlier, you know, networks, people, you know, there are people probably who collaborate with people who look like them intentionally. There probably is a percentage of that, right? But I feel like this is a symptom, and we can take efforts to fix the larger problem in that, basically diversifying who we collaborate with as well. But to try to control, I think, and aim just for this outcome, like to target this outcome, I think it belies what the real problem
and
is.
And could lead to some unintentional, or perhaps intentional, tokenism.
Yes.
Could lead to some tokenism. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So fix the bigger problem, not just the symptoms.
And that starts with addressing it, I think, with yourself and just taking a moment to go, it's unacceptable at this point, particularly in the social media world and the online connected world that we live in as academics, to say, well, I just don't know any people of color that are in my field, or I just don't know anyone who I could reach out to learn about their science, not necessarily to collaborate, but just to learn out to, you know, it's identifying that. And like you said, that sort of unconscious, collaborating with people who look like yourself, or are like yourself. Absolutely. And one good way I would recommend to start with that is next time you're suggesting reviewers or you're rejecting yes. doing a review, think long and hard. That's an opportunity to get to know more people. Yourself in your field, not necessarily reach out to them, but
use the Diversify EEB website. Look at, you know, I think it would be interesting to really look at who people are citing. Are you citing primarily men, even without realizing it? That would obviously be a much more difficult, you know, kind of textual breakdown look, but you know, kind of look at those kind of hidden biases as well. But I think this is a symptom of a much bigger problem. And so to control just for the symptom, I think, like I said, just kind of misses the point.
Something I kind of tried to allude to is, like, you know, if one symptom or one outcome of, you know, people wanting to diversify their collaborator lists is more collaborative opportunities for these scientists, then, you know, by extension, that raises the stature of these scientists, and will have, you know, positive benefits in terms of, you know, rectifying biases and, you know, making younger scientists who identify with those, you know, more established people feel more welcome in the field. And, I think that this is really important, and this is a pretty small thing that, you know, every scientist can, contribute to pretty easily, right?
Mm-hmm. Heck yes. Yes, sir. You are correct, sir.
I like it.
So speaking of interacting with new scientists, one of the times that we do that is when we go to meetings and we're presenting, right? And so one of the ways you can present, did you like that segue right there? One of the ways that you do that, right, is through either oral presentations or poster presentations. And I don't think this is a hot take to say that by and large, most poster presentations are a real bummer. And not when you individually are talking to the person, but like when I'm at a session, particularly if that poster session is at the end of the day, and all I'm seeing is just this wall of text coming at me, I'm over it. And I'm just going to head to the snack station in the bar and go talk to some colleagues. And I know it's a missed opportunity to learn some really cool things because fantastic science is being presented, but it's just so damn hard. So there's this new video that came out very, very recently with a new suggestion, a proposal to change posters to just one sentence that's the main take home in the middle, with maybe a QR code, maybe one very simple graph, And then that's pretty much it. Like, that's the main visual for 75% of the poster. Then there's some other small information on the sides that you can use during your presentation. You all know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about.
So, what do you think? Do you buy it? What do you think?
No, this is an asinine solution. It's a clear problem, but it's an asinine solution because it... Yeah, I don't think this is right. I mean, this... Okay, so this goes back to... This is something John and I were talking about randomly. You know, the problem with the expectation on scientists today is that you're expected to be an excellent researcher, an excellent writer, communicator, project manager, you know, budget planner, and also freaking graphic designer too, right? I agree. The typical template that's used for posters is terrible. This, however, takes a very exciting medium, you know, that has a lot of potential, that a lot of people have done really good things with, and makes it completely boring in a different way. Right?
Yeah.
Like the principles that he cites, you know, as far as like have some design, you know, basis in design, that's fine. I don't mind having, you know, these big bullet points and ideas. And I love QR codes. I've been using QR codes for, you know, 5 or 6 years.
Jeff is the hipster of QR codes.
I know, right? Old school. I was doing QR codes back in the day. And I can also tell you the stats on QR codes, just no one fucking uses them, okay? Because, like, that's the thing about QR codes is they give you stats. No one gives a shit. So, like, also, like, I don't even tell people to use them anymore because no one cares. The other thing about your poster is that for most major conferences, and for small ones too, and for other things, like, your poster gets used in a digital medium. Right, and is preserved for like e-posters, online poster archives, and poster also serves as something that you can do for handouts and give to other people and, you know, lives in perpetuity beyond that conference. So I think you're taking the problem with posters and creating a new problem and further trivializing posters. So I am very much against this format and have seen a lot of people on Twitter today who I highly respect talking about, you know, I think there's some interesting thought come out of this. I think the conclusion is fascinating.
Well, okay, so I think part of that gets to the idea of what is the purpose of a poster? Is it a tool for communicating in person at that session? Or it sounds like that you're saying that a poster needs to have longevity outside of the presentation.
It can be both.
Well, I would challenge that if your purpose in creating this poster is for that hour where you're standing there and engaging people to have a conversation, this might be a really effective mm-hmm. strategy. But if you want your poster to have any bit of longevity, like hanging up in the hallway outside your lab, right? Or anything like that, you know, that's how scientists decorate. Then it does not work.
Those posters give benefit years after. I have people infrequently email me about posters I have in cart call, meaning like it happens every 6 months or so, right? Posters that are like,
hey, routine has nothing to do with frequency, right? Just with
it's recurring. That's right. It's a pattern. But I'm just saying, like, those things exist in perpetuity. If, you know, like, yeah, we need to do a better job, but this is not the way.
All right. So can I say what I like about this?
Sure, this is your podcast. You say whatever you want.
It's yours too. But mostly that was just meant as like an interjection that was like marginally polite.
I mean, granted, only I think 33% of the episodes featured more than one woman. So there have been some that are 50% women, but there are very few. I think there are just three. But sorry.
So John, what do you like?
Okay, so one thing I like is that this idea of like a one sentence summary of the key result, kind of, I'm assuming that that's also the title of the poster, right? When it gets submitted, like, so having a concise statement about like what the poster actually says. I think that's a fantastic idea, right? Like, I'm gonna set up a straw man to fight against this, but like the, you know, the poster that says, you know, exploration of the, you know, role of, you know, blah 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 in blah blah blah, like that doesn't say anything.
No,
that says something very vague about what the poster is actually about. And so then you're forced into either not caring about the poster or thinking, well, okay, I like blah 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 and blah blah blah, so maybe I'll take the time to actually, like, you know, skim the, you know, the wall of text that this poster is. So that's a long-winded way of saying, like, I like the idea of giving a very, like, informative title that's like a concise statement about what you actually found. And, you know, placing that front and center, and making that very big so that someone, you know, just passing by, like, that's easy to find. I also like the idea of, you know, using a QR code, which apparently is, you know, a little bit passe, you know, to, like, link to more information about the poster, you know, a digital copy of it, like, what have you. What I really wish I saw differently in the examples in that video were examples of a poster where instead of, like, you know, a 12-inch by 12-inch QR code in the middle, there's a big graphic.
Yeah.
You know, a big map, a big, you know, line graph, you know, whatever helps to tell the story. Because really, like, we don't want to just talk about what you did. We want to see your data.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And we want to be able to interact with it. And I don't think that, you know, sticking it in a, you know, little sidebar that, you know, you can only read if you're standing right next to it, you know, does that. I don't think that we necessarily need to put a ton of text out. I don't think that we necessarily need to put, you know, three different tables of, you know, correlation coefficients and p-values and, you know,
no,
f-tests.
We don't need a table.
Right. You know, so, you know, get rid of that stuff or, like, you know, make it tiny, you know, so you can point to it or whatever. But, you know, give us a clear statement about what we should take away from your poster. Give us some big, easy to, you know, read, you know, you can see them from 5 feet away graphics. And that for me is what makes a good poster.
I agree with you. I think that maybe a hybridization of this new sort of extreme template with more traditional poster, like maybe take that middle 75% and split it into a couple of boxes that have the main takeaway. Here's the main graphic that, the graph that, you know, the data that support that main takeaway, and then maybe a little bit about the methods or some discussion at the bottom. Nothing in full sentences. Nothing in full sentences. Let me say that one more time. Never put a full sentence on a poster. I don't want to read it.
Yeah.
All right. I'm gonna push this a little more. Okay, so one of the issues that this gentleman, who I'm sure is a very nice gentleman, highlights is that he's like, this will save your students a lot of time. Okay, so it also saves you a lot of time to cut and paste a lot of text and just throw it on a poster. And that's, you know, those posters are done very quickly. So by having your students, quote unquote, save time making a poster in this simplified format, that, again, completely ignores the actual dynamics and potential of the poster format, is that you are preventing them from learning how to describe their science and tell their story in a different format. So you're preventing them from learning that skill. You know, writing's fine. Writing's great. It's wonderful. But also, like, being able to explain yourself visually. You know, it doesn't have to be super complex. It doesn't have to be one of these, you know, really ornate infographics. If that's not your skill set and not something that you want to utilize, that's fine. There's other ways that are simple and elegant that allow you to express that. But, you know, communicating your science is important. The poster format is a tried and true, when done right, way of being able to express and tell a story in a different format. So trivializing that further by saying, this will cut time by taking this template and just copying a big sentence and moving on, you're also doing the same thing and trivializing that form while also saying that you don't want to do that. So, like, in that way, the more I think about it, the more offended I am by this, actually. Like, you're shitting on an entire field of graphic design completely. Like, completely. You know, like, completely ignoring a whole, you know, series of, like, science communication of all the people who have done work to create, you know, to help scientists, people learn to communicate graphics and data in more interesting and clear, clean visual ways. Completely ignoring that. I'm very against this. The more
I don't disagree with anything that you said, and I 100% believe that it is our job, and as scientists as well as mentors, to be teaching people and working to be better communicators in that visual format. And it is a missed opportunity. One thing, though, I will say is I remember back at UVA when we were grad students, I think it was our second year, there was this big on-campus research symposium. I forget what it was called. You all remember. It's like Cavalier Days or something.
The Robert J. Husky Graduate Research
Symposium. Thank you. There it is. And I was my first time presenting a poster in my graduate research. I was really excited. I'd spent so much time making the graphics, really working on this, right? And I put my poster up, and a woman comes, another student, next to me, and starts pinning pieces of paper up onto the board in her poster area. She took her nature paper, granted, nature paper, really cool, and pinned up a copy of it. And the judges came by, and they looked at everybody's posters, and they interacted with her. It was really cool. I'm certain that this woman is on the verge of curing cancer. She's an amazing scientist. I'm not trying to take that away from her.
Yeah.
And you want to know what? We get to the award ceremony. She won a fucking Best Poster Presentation Award. So you want to know what? A lot of people do phone it in. And at least if she'd taken that paper and copied it into this template format, like, at least she would have put in some effort and it would have been a better communication tool.
I don't know, man. Printing off one sentence is harder or easier than printing off 12 pages.
Yeah, well, at least she would have had to have formatted into a PowerPoint slide.
Also, as like
a I clearly am a little salty about this stuff, by the way.
No, that's fair. That's fair. You've identified a different problem. But, you know, also, like, as a session organizer, if you send me the title of your poster and it's just a long sentence that's a main finding, I'm going to reject that because I don't think you know how to write a title.
What?
Well, I mean, it depends.
That, like, does not hold to the...
I don't think it holds.
Right? Like, obviously that's a spectrum, right? I'm just saying. It doesn't have to be jargon filled.
I mean, I think paper titles that are like the takeaway finding are great.
Yeah.
Okay, but like the ones on in that poster.
Oh, yeah, no, they were not good. I have a hypothesis, and I think it's probably not correct, but what if this person was proposing this as a way to say, here's an extreme, and this isn't actually what I mean, but here's like such an extreme versus showing the posters. Those were real life posters. People really do that. They just put blocks of text, right?
Yeah.
They do. And so if here's the extreme, if I could just move the needle from those block of text people a little bit, then we'd all kind of meet in the middle at a place that is a better communication tool.
So you think taking a Trumpian approach of moving the Overton window of poster presentations at science conferences is what we need to do to move forward?
And I'm not advocating for this. I'm hypothesizing that this could be a strategy.
That's fair.
I don't think it's accurate, but maybe we could.
I'm pretty sure we're at yes. We're at yes.
I agree with you. So. That is the Trumpian approach.
I also just like using the phrase Overton window. It makes me feel smart. So. Fine. Okay.
All right. So what other debates have been happening?
So Amy Bergen posted this, excellent scientist from the University of Kansas, brought up on Twitter how a reviewer was questioning the validity and utility of sand pits, or sand pit lakes, as whether or not they were actual real, quote unquote, ecosystems. And so this led to a discussion about human-impacted ecosystems. They get a lot of gatekeeping. So, and Grace, I think you posed this, you know, is this a thing outside of limnology? I didn't realize this was a thing inside limnology. Is this a big, is this a bigger trend than just
A bit, yes. And I think it actually is a little bit more at ecology at large, in thinking about like urban ecosystems and things like that. So the direct quote that she posted on Twitter from this reviewer was that the reviewer said, "I need to be convinced that these are indeed ecosystems. The ecosystems sound like mines filled with water. Are the authors implying they're models for real lakes? They are fucking real lakes. Oh, a lake is just like, oh my God."
I forgot right. It was that bad. Yeah. I remember reading this and being pissed off at the time, but yeah, okay.
It's funny. Like, it's not funny because it's real, but it's right? funny.
I know.
But
I know.
It's just absolutely ludicrous. And so, yes, I think there is definitely a lot of that. So limnology was born out of a tradition, particularly prior to World War II and into World War II, of landed gentry, we'll call them, or my new favorite phase, stale pale males. Going up to pristine wildernesses, quote unquote, as mostly glacial kettle lakes, sampling a bunch of them, and that was limnology. And we learned a lot from that. But it turns out that even though the majority of the lakes in the world, by numbers, might be those types of ecosystems that are largely, quote unquote, untouched directly by humans, although climate change, atmospheric deposition, they're not all untouched, that's false. The ecosystems that we interact with the most, the aquatic ecosystems, are really heavily impacted by humans. And they're things like sandpit lakes and barrow pits and reservoirs and dammed riverways and ta-da-ta-da-ta-da-ta-da, right? And those are the aquatic ecosystems that you're actually, yes, first they are ecosystems, and the ones that we're interacting with the most.
And yeah, ecology happens.
Right. There. And so I'm just wondering, like, is this not something in more the terrestrial or other sides of ecology that people are like, oh, no, you can't say that that like set of trees that was planted in the park, that's not an ecosystem.
First of all, I never saw a natural lake until I was in my 30s. But I'm from like the South. Like, we don't right. have natural lakes. Like, we don't. You make a lake.
It's, turns out you do that here in Iowa too, but that's because you drained all the original ones. But carry on.
Yeah. There's definitely, you know, this fetishization for natural systems, quote unquote, whatever a natural system is, right? You know, these pristine sites, and you know, I think we think of them as reference systems a lot of times, for whatever that means. Even though our reference systems oftentimes, you know, 100 years ago were like clear cut if they were forest or something else, right? You know, it's I don't know. I think this goes back honestly to like we were talking about when we did historical ecology papers a while back, and we were talking to, you know, I think I brought some of the papers looking at, you know, the Cowles and Gleason ecological succession and climax theory, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, I think that's a moot point. Like, it's everywhere is impacted. Like, we're all climate change scientists at this point. Like, you just are, because everything's affected. Like, there is no place that does not have the imprint of human activity. There isn't. It's in the deep ocean, it's in the far reaches of the Arctic, it's in the glaciers, it's in Greenland, it's everywhere. And so to, you know, to parse things in this way, I think is not useful. Now, are there extremes? Yeah, probably, right? Like, they're probably extremes. Like, I think of, you know, a lot of times, like, dealing with trees, you use these, like, allometric equations. So basically doing allometry, like, if you want to scale the biomass of something, you do it based on, like, measurements of the size. You know, we know that in urban systems, they're different, honestly, than they are in a more contiguous forest. But that's just often a product of the fact that it's just a thing with trees, right? Like, when they're in urban environments, they're typically by themselves and they're exposed, and so they just kind of respond.
Well, are they lonely and they get fat?
A tree,
okay.
Yeah, basically, like a tree in an open, like a tree in an open area grows different than a tree in a forest. It just does, right? In urban environments, they tend to be more fragmented and they tend to be open. They're still forest, though.
They get trimmed, but, like, too.
Just one. Yeah, so it's just like, I mean, yeah, there's ways to account for it, but, like, to parse whether or not something is an ecosystem just seems silly.
Yeah, I think particularly, like, in this instance, it's this gatekeeping about, like, apparently there's one hydrologic norm for a lake, which I would love to visit that lake because I've never freaking seen it. And that's what a real lake is, and then everything else is not a proxy for a lake. It's some other. It's really weird. Okay, so it's good to know that this is happening in other places, but limnologists might just be a little extreme.
I've always been kind of confused about the definition of a lake because, like, colloquially, a lake is large, but, like, in limnology, it's pretty much just, like, a body of water that is most of the time there.
I think that is accurate. There isn't a definition of a lake. You're right. It is so... Oh, my gosh. Excellent point, Jen.
Has somebody written a paper?
I'm sure David Siegel has.
Friend of the podcast, Siegel, get at us. I want to read Siegel 2019. What is a lake? Is it based on a Pareto distribution? Like somehow,
I'm sure.
There's like an inverse power law thing that describes what a lake is.
Don't give him ideas.
You know, he's going to listen to this, and he's going to send me a text about it at some point, I know. So, he finally has daylight for the first time in a while, so maybe he'll actually get to work instead. Jim Heffernan had a really good follow-up, too, that you linked us to, Grace, and so we'll put a link to both Jim's and, you know, Amy's original threads, and I think Jim had some really good points about, you know, anthropogenic systems and you know, kind of how they're impacted and how, you know, studying this is a kind of important thing.
Yes, his take is much more thoughtful and less sweary than mine.
Well, he doesn't have a podcast, so. Friend of the podcast, Terry McGlynn, posted a long thread. We're just pulling Twitter today. Like, this is just what's in ecology Twitter week, this episode. So this is the, if I were running an EEB department right now, I'd be gathering information about best practices and policies for recruitment and advising from other disciplines. And so basically what this long thread is just individual points about what's weird about ecology departments and quote unquote, what's weird about ecology departments and kind of potential issues going through there. So are there some big hits for you guys you want to talk about in this, or do you want to just kind of go through them? Some of these are pretty standard, but
yeah,
really these are meant to be like thoughtful points.
Yeah. So I think one of them that I found particularly interesting and is a good point is how common it is for graduate students to be expected to rely on unpaid labor to generate the data used for their dissertation. So whether that's what they're doing, the amount of field work required, or another form of that is having undergrads, right, and unpaid labor in doing it, and that they don't necessarily, have control over that decision. How about you? Well, there's one, I know we were talking about the next one, right? It's almost never any required safety or first aid training.
Oh yeah, we'll get into that. But yeah, to your point on number three, the idea of, you know, expected to rely on unpaid labor, you know, and there, because that's, it becomes a power dynamic, right? Because you want to like advocate for people to pay people, like, you know, my lab does, we pride ourselves on being able to do that. And that's a bigger issue in ecology. I think we've talked about, you know, before, and there's some good stuff on that. But there's definitely, yeah, that's a systemic issue that needs to get in there. But yeah, we should probably have a whole episode on that at some point. A lot of these actually can be whole episodes. But the required safety thing is quite the bugbear for me. You know, you're putting people out in these often remote areas or. Just, you know, if you're doing like field work ecology, a lot of times it's you're out in the woods and you're exposed to the elements, and we're putting people out there with no safety training whatsoever. And when I think about this, like, you know, when I worked in mental health, I did this for 6 years. I would get trainings once every month or two on something, like everything, and every year I was required to do trainings, which I understand, like, it's health field related, right? So I did stuff like bloodborne pathogens, CPR, basic first aid. I did how to handle like level one, level two traumas and whatnot, right? Like how to handle intakes, how to, you know, I am trained in medication dispersal and, you know, quantification and whatnot, and like standard principles of prescriptions and like how to fill out med forms, like all the stuff, like train constantly. We get nothing. I was better trained when I was in Boy Scouts.
Mm-hmm.
Like far better trained. I mean, like I, you know, this is just a product where I've, you know, but like I've had defensive driving training. I have had wilderness first aid training. I have had survival skill training. Like I don't question what I go out and do crazy stuff. I do crazy shit and that's fine. And people give me a hard time about it, but like, I know what I'm doing, but like, I don't have the ability, the money or the resources to be able to provide my students with these training, nor do I have any institutional leverage or interest in doing that. And a lot of times the students themselves are even dismissive of the need for this because they have never experienced anything. You know, they've never been bleeding out in the woods before or trapped somewhere. And I don't know what to do. like, tell me. Help me.
So I think it needs to come down to... The institutional support and the funding is definitely a big thing. And something that I inherited, this was not something that I came up with on my own, because I also didn't have that in grad school, any of that training. And we were in remote areas and doing things. Is that I inherited with this long-term monitoring program that there's this training week that we have for students. And that involves that everybody who's working in the field has to go to first aid and CPR training, which is a full day in that training week, paid time, and the training's paid for. And we have another set of like sit down in the classroom full half day talking about all sorts of different field incidences and safety issues and how to go through and training for those. So thinking about like tornado warnings and things like that, which often happen in the Midwest. And that has been huge, both from a knowing that my students have some common sense plus some training in them when they're out there. And by students, I mean undergrads, technicians, grad students, everyone. And then from a liability standpoint, too, like, I don't understand the lack of institutional support. That's just liability. Like, how are they not covering themselves? That makes no sense to me.
I don't understand.
So my take on this is that a lot of, and I don't, legally, I don't know if or why this makes sense. It may totally not. But, you know, it seems like a lot of what universities take seriously from a liability standpoint are things that happen or could happen on campus. And like, I've been genuinely frustrated, and you know, maybe I should be less so, but like, dude, I haven't been in a chemistry lab since since I took intro chem when I was 19. And like, every place that I've, you know, moved, I've had to, you know, at least do an online module about laboratory safety.
John, the people don't even follow that. They don't wear lab coats. They don't wear gloves.
Listen, I'm sure that they don't, but like, you know,
millennials have killed the safety industry.
I guess like, you know, part of my point, I guess, is like, you know, yeah, we should totally have, you know, training, but we should have training that is like, is actually relevant to the things that we do and not like a, you know, that's not just like a foolish, you know, checking the box. And I think that's where a lot of the push, you know, pushback for this stuff comes. You know, kind of similarly with like, you know, complying with, you know, HR and stuff like that. You know, point two is like, says it's typical for grad students and postdocs to get recruited even though no position is advertised. It's just about networking with the PI and being invited to apply. And I mean, honestly, like, I'll admit to have been, you know, frustrated by, you know, HR requirements on, you know, doing an official search for a position and stuff like that when I'm just like, I just want to hire this person. But yeah, like, I also realized that there, you know, that there is a point to that. And, just by, you know, keeping so many positions, you know, based on networking and, you know, who you know, it makes it hard for people that don't have the same access to, you know, to networks to break into the field.
Yeah, this one's a good point. Like, it's really difficult. Like, I don't know how you address that.
Well, it needs to be, I think, a change in attitude from down with the bureaucracy to, like, make the bureaucracy relevant. Or figure out how the bureaucracy is relevant to you. Yeah.
And
it also becomes a function of, like, you know, a lot of times these, or if you're attached to a project or something funded, like, it comes in with a grant cycle. And so the grant cycle for each individual grant or each individual director at each individual department doesn't necessarily line up with an academic calendar. So you're already starting from the starting point. You know, if I have this project kicking off in 3 months, I need to hire somebody. And so it's not, these things are not coordinated across the entities, which they need to be. So you're already starting from a big deficit.
Yeah. Less in this thread, but another thing that Terry talked about was sort of like having diffuse hierarchies and power structures. And I think that that's one of the ways that you can enable this idea of, you know, having requirements, having resources, but having them be flexible to what, you know, things that actually apply to, you know, a particular you know, department, a particular graduate program, something like that.
What do you think about the proposal in here to not have the PI be the committee chair for a student? I don't like it. Because, I mean, I think it's, you know, there's a couple of people who made this point on here, like, it's just because of a couple bad actors, to change this would be a big deal because the overwhelming majority, you know, of advisors have a vested interest in that student's work and moving them forward. And it's good to have that advocate. Not all cases, obviously, you know, and there are cases where there are good, well-intentioned advisors who also keep students for longer than they probably should too, just to keep them around. But, you know, it's something said to have somebody in a committee who is invested in that student's future. You know, particularly like has a career interest in them, not only from a mentorship, but also like, you know, the student produce papers and produce research projects for you, you know, moving you forward as well. Like it's supposed to be this mutualistic relationship, right? So I think having somebody in charge of a committee who doesn't have that vested interest could be potentially very troublesome.
But
I think... I think the devil's in the details, right? Like, if the sort of non-PI committee chair is, you know, their job is really to sort of chair the committee in the sense of, you know, running it and making sure that, you know, milestones are met and meetings go, you know, smoothly, then that might work okay. That might work well, because that doesn't necessarily, you know, break this sort of like mutualism between advisor and advisee. But it may provide a little bit of a check, on, you know, what could be a toxic mentor-mentee relationship. But yeah, I think the devil is in the details with that. I kind of share some of your concerns that, you know, the good PIs, and I think, you know, based on my experience, most PIs are good PIs, you know, do have a role in advocating for the student, in committee meetings, and that can be at, you know, that can be important.
Now, so there are these universities, one I'm thinking of in particular, where the undergraduate advising is actually done by professional advising staff within the department and not the professors, right? And so I think that's a really good advantage for undergraduate students, because you're getting someone who actually knows the system and who's up on that and who's professionally focused in this role. And their role is to support and advise you and not something like professor. It's just not, particularly at the undergraduate level, it's difficult for professors.
Oh, to do that, right, my Grace? Gosh. I mean, it seems yes. Like, yeah. It is the most has been the most stressful part of my week this week. It is awful. And it, like, just because I don't know. They expect me to know everything right. about this giant university. I don't know.
Yeah.
But like at the graduate level, it's different. Now, you could say if you had this as like maybe a couple people in a department, which then the question becomes like who's going to pay them? Where's that money going to come from? Like, or maybe if it's just one, I don't know, who his job is to like oversee the committee for people and is more like you said like a mediation role and a role in like just making sure things are in progress or in report and things are getting met, right? And they mediate and arrange you know, meetings or whatnot between people, and like there's still like, you know, an academic advisor per se, or your research advisor, or whatever is the major professor. I don't know. Maybe, I mean, I could see a potential for that moving forward. Questions, I don't know how you pay for it. But you know, I can see an advantage in that, and I don't think that would be a huge overhaul of having someone professionally devoted to that. But you know, I see pitfalls with that as well.
Yeah, dude, I love the idea of sort of like, you know, formally or informally sort of like professionalizing this role. I mean, we mentioned this earlier, like the idea that academics are supposed to simultaneously be good at a million different things is just like utterly unrealistic. And, you know, I really like, you know, I don't like, you know, underpaid adjunct and lecturer positions, but I love in general, you know, the idea of, you know, valued roles, well-compensated roles, secure roles for people who specialize in teaching. You know, I love, you know, roles for people who specialize in research. I love roles for people that, you know, specialize in, you know, mentoring and advising. And, you know, I want to see those, you know, be valued on, you know, a commensurate basis. But, yeah, I mean, I think that has so many potential benefits.
So, I mean, yeah, I think there are ways to realize this. So I'm not totally dismissive of it, but I want there to be, you know, research driven mentorship in there as you know.
So some programs do have that though. And I think it does work. So like at Iowa State, not quite to that level, but like we didn't have this at Virginia, right? But at Iowa State, we have two people for each interdepartmental program. All of our grad programs are interdepartmental. And there's one person who is much more the administrative, bureaucratic, keeps on track, touches base with the grad students once a semester type role. And one person who is the DOGE, the Director of Graduate Education, and they are the mediator. Like when there's issues with your PI, when there's issues with your committee, blah, 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 XYZ. Hey, I really want to go take this course on ecosystem ecology, but I need it to count towards my program of study. Like that's the person who makes those decisions and has power for that too. And so that kind of helps fill that role in that there's another person there. It's not just your PI with control over you. And there's another person looking out for you for those milestones too.
Yeah. I like that a lot.
It can work, but it also puts a lot of time and energy on a hopefully research active faculty. So.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, I think there is a win-win situation here, but it has to be, you know, a well-supported role. And you know, this is not going to be something that every university is going to be fiscally able to do. It's just, but then, I don't know, maybe you shouldn't have a PhD program. Not everyone needs a PhD program. So whatever. That's another role. For another. All right, let's go to, I think, an easy one. Number 5, students often aren't even allowed to have ownership or control over their own data. So I think this is written, this is Twitter-fied. I think he's saying something different than what he's saying, because obviously you probably don't own your data. Grace, can you enlighten people? Because that may be a shock to some people that you
right. don't own. Right, so your data belong to the funding agency and the PI who probably wrote that grant. You could be the PI of that grant, so you could have some ownership over it. And then the third person who belongs to is the institution. But when you collect data for part of your dissertation, let's say that research is being funded by a specific granting agency and you're major professor wrote the grant, they were the PI of the grant, you don't own those data in perpetuity. You don't get to decide who gets to publish on them, who has access to them. That's not the case. You probably, and hopefully if you have a good major professor, you have first crack at those data, and your group probably hopefully has some sort of publishing or authorship agreement so that you know that in future collaborations that use those data, that you have a chance at authorship if you fulfill some steps. And already have by collecting those, but you do not own them. And you do not get to take them with you when you leave.
I think the... Exactly, yeah. I think the bulk of this point, though, is talking about the power of the PI over a student's project is more what he meant as far as, like, the directiveness of a PI over that. And I think we probably agree that there's some truth to that sometime, necessarily. But, I mean, I don't know. I felt a lot of autonomy over my own project, but... Maybe that's probably not true for some people.
Yeah. So. Well, and one thing I've been exposed to recently that I really like in other labs is having like authorship agreements and lab understand like agreements. Like this is what gets you authorship in our lab. This is what we think authorship is. And then also for students, it's like, you know, you have first crack at the data in your dissertation chapters and you do this, but our goal and our fulfillment of getting this funding is we have to put the data and the findings out there. So you have X number of months, maybe 12 or 18 from when you graduate to be actively working on putting that towards publication, not publish it, but towards publication. And if you don't, then I reserve the right to take over as corresponding author. And you're still on that publication. So I think there's ways, like, you need to have those explicit agreements.
I like it. This brought up your idea of the lab doc, too, which I think we should visit in another episode at some point, because I want to go deeper into that, about developing lab culture, even how to build a lab. I think we could probably move on from this if y'all are in agreement, because the other part's about, like, we don't get a lot of information on how to mentor students. We don't. We're not... Which also, the lost episode of Major Revisions had to do with mentoring, so maybe we'll revisit that. I don't know. Vast majority of doctoral students not headed for faculty positions. That's true, but there was also some information in Science that came out today about where doctoral students are that's kind of interesting that I think changes that slightly. But, yeah, unless y'all got another thing, I'm going to move on to the next point, because we're actually well over an hour. Casually dropping your wife and kids in a job talk. I looked for the tweet that mentioned this week, and I could not find it, so my apologies to who did the original one there. But apparently this is a thing that has been done before and recently where particularly white folk...
White male folk.
Still pale males.
Still... soon to be stale pale males, I assume, if they're trying to get a job, just casually or particularly like in acknowledgments will work in like, oh, I'd like to thank my wife and children for you know, hard work in this, and just kind of like name checking that, which is, you know, from a job talk, like if you're a dude, there is a game theory thought there that puts you at an advantage to some people. And so that way I think people would do that. Now, granted, I have inadvertently name checked my kids in a job interview before, because I told you all this offline. Like, I was talking about something and explaining like this process, and the comment that I came up and I caught myself afterwards was, you know, I was talking about how like, oh, this, you know, thinking of this like voxelization process of like cutting things up into blocks reminds me of, you know, playing Minecraft with my kids. Which you've never played, you should play Minecraft. It's a fun game. It's like 8-bit pixels and you're building stuff. It's fun. It's an exciting game. And so like, I caught myself after, I was like, oh, fuck. You know, because like, it's just, you know, like in job interviews, like, you just don't talk about it. It's fine. Like, if it comes up, it comes up, right? Because you mean you're talking to people and relating to them on a personal level.
Or they're asking the question illegally, but hopefully you're more relating on a personal level.
Yeah, hopefully they're not asking the question illegally, right? Like, I don't mind volunteering like some information about having a family, just because like, also like, I want to get to know the people in the department and also like schools in the area and where to raise kids. But like, it's such a weird, murky thing, right? And it's obviously they can't ask and it's illegal. But also like, I kind of want to know, like, these are people I'm going to be working with. Like, do we have something in common here? Like, is this something we can agree on? I don't know, because it's so weird for academics. and awkward, but also, like, just dropping your kids in a talk? No. That's weird.
It's weird.
Yeah. Don't do that. I'm sorry I did it. It was a mistake. I'm sorry, guys.
I mean, I, like...
I didn't mean to.
I don't know. I don't feel like it's weird if that just sort of, like, comes up in conversation, but, like, you know, I have never been tempted to give my wife an acknowledgement in a talk, like...
Yeah, just... I mean, is this weird, like, is me, like, being the only one that's really having kids, like, is something that comes up and whatnot? Because, like, I mean, I guess, like, job interviews, like, I occasionally have put pictures of my kids because I take my kids to do field work. Should I not do that either? Like, it's just, well, I don't know, like, it's a huge part of
who I am, too. And that shouldn't be denied. And I'm not trying to say, oh, you're doing anything wrong, but something to consider is that if I had children and I were to put a picture, I would be taking a much bigger risk and would probably be impacted negatively, whereas the impact for you is likely neutral. Yeah. I'm guessing it's not positive, but it's probably neutral.
Yeah, no, it's usually neutral to positive, because if anything, it more humanizes me, whereas you're right. You got to realize it is kind of like a negative impact for...
Or has the potential to, yeah.
Unfairly. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. No,
but it is a big part about who you are and whatnot. So, yeah, I'm not, again, I'm not trying to diminish that or take that away, and that is very true. But
no, I've tried to make, you know, efforts of not doing that before. Like, I've done it with some of the, like, the stuff, like, related to Shenandoah, like the watershed study, because, like, you know, they would come out with me a lot on doing that. So I've tried not to do that. And so, like, it was something, like, kind of inadvertent, like, in this one more recently. But, like, you know, when it comes to stuff like Twitter, which transitioned into our last thing on here is Twitter. You know, like, the approach that I take to Twitter is that I am probably a little bit more personal than most of the science professionals on Twitter. You know, probably 30 to 40% of what I post, maybe even half, is more personal related. And so, like, you know, I don't mention my kids by name. I don't mention my kids by name on this podcast. You know, that's intentional, right? Like, that's, I want to give them that agency to privatize as much as I can about their life. So I refer to them as the older or the younger. The younger or the elder. And, but, you know, I talk about them on here in some because they are part of my life. And I think it is important for us as scientists to be humans as well. But, you know, I completely acknowledge what you say, Grace. And that's true. And something that, you know, I have a privilege in doing that it is a neutral for me majority of the time. But, you know, when it comes to Twitter, like, that's, I don't know how to not do it. Like, it feels disingenuous. To not, and so it's very difficult for me in that respect. But I think it can be a pretty bright line for certain things, like in job talks in particular. But I don't know. This is something I guess I want to think more about, but I'm open to comments from y'all.
In a job talk, you're in a specific person or, like, professional setting being evaluated on your professional skills. That's different than Twitter. So I think those are two different things, in my opinion. I don't know. What do you think, John?
I agree with that. Yeah.
All right. I'm just curious. Sometimes, you know, just want to be thoughtful. Because, you know, we all have different learned and lived life experiences. And, you know, I always like the human, you know, the human experience that we kind of all share. And then and being able to humanize people. You know, one of my favorite things on Twitter is learning that some of the people I work with professionally are really frustrated by airplane seats, or learning that they also, to me, are like me, have weird extreme reactions to certain foods or whatnot. Like, I like the human experience of that, and that's sometimes, it's like a relatable thing. But the other aspect of Twitter, speaking of Twitter, the dumpster fire of an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education. I like this. I don't know who wrote this, but it sounds like something I would write, so I like it. From an elitist ivory tower type, the Twitterization of the academic mind. I don't even want to talk the name of whoever wrote this, and I don't even care, but this article's trash.
This is everything that's awful about academia in 1,000 words.
Oh, that is so true, John. That is a perfect take.
Isn't it called the right. Academy? How do you even pronounce that? Is that only in Chronicle of Higher Ed? Do they edit that in? The A-C-A-D-E-M-E? Or do people write that?
I would believe this guy wrote it.
Okay. I think it's sort of like, I mean, I think it's pretty elitist, first of all, just to write that word.
I will never write that word intentionally without it being in quotation marks in jest.
Yeah. I don't know how you pronounce it properly, because I've never pronounced it properly.
Academy. That's my guess. I don't know.
I think yes, and in that exact intonation. It's interesting that this person's making the case that the Academy is constituted through a sustained attention of academics themselves. It is closed. It is closed to those who cannot understand its conventions or think, speak, and act through its particular registers. That's like actually saying we're better than, like, that is just so elitist and like blatantly elitist. I don't even know what to do. Like, this wasn't a joke piece, I'm pretty certain.
Yeah, this should have been in McSweeney's. Which, if you were a learned academic, you would know what that was. If you don't, then clearly we're better than you.
Oh.
I hope people get how much like sarcasm that I actually say. I assume people do. But I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe I'm just a giant ass too. My favorite thing is he references something from like 1478 in this. I forgot what it was, but 1478.
Oh, it was whoever was printing after the Gutenberg Bible. It was probably Oxford or somebody like that.
Yeah. Cool. We did a lot of shitty things in 1478. I'm not sure we should go back to that
time period. Like,
I don't know, man. This is just wrong. This is more wrong than the postal thing, clearly.
My favorite quote, though, was that we communicate our research findings. We synthesize scholarly debates. We provide critical new perspectives. And collectively, we provide a bulwark against the hot takes, the meme, and the quip. So we appreciate you listeners for listening to us for our hot takes, memes, and quips, because that's pretty much what we do.
We are a hot take machine. We agree on everything for the most part. None of us really take any extreme hot takes, I think. Hold on. I got to find my favorite quote, too. I need one for all having favorite quotes. Nah, never mind. It's just all terrible. Grace, why do you use Twitter?
Why do I use Twitter? I use Twitter because it connects me to a community that I otherwise wouldn't have access to. And particularly, I think, in grad school and as a postdoc, when I, circling back to our first topic, didn't have a lot of other women role models around or like any at all, it was really important for me for that and thinking that I could get into this field.
Ha. John, what have you, in the month or so that you've been on Twitter, has your opinion changed or what's your experience been like?
Dude, I don't even like Twitter that much. And I still think this is a douchey article. No, but so I do have some Twitter resolutions. And you know, I think one of the things that I really like seeing from it is ways that you know, we can amplify our work and the work of our colleagues and just, you know, papers or presentations or whatever that we think are cool. And so, you know, one of my goals for my Twitter life is to start doing that to a greater degree.
How about you, Jeff? Why do you use Twitter?
I adopted Twitter early on, probably before I even did QR codes. No, I've been on Twitter since 2009, I think. Like a long time. Because I'm hipster AF. But, so I like Twitter for a lot of reasons. One, because I hate Facebook. Like, it's Twitter to me is this instantaneous thing. It's honestly, it has a utility for news that is non-existent in literally any other form. Right? You can Google and find literally anything on Twitter of what is actually happening. And if you know how to use it, you can find out a wealth of information. It connects me to a huge community of folks, you know, in science and kind of beyond as well. right? Like, you know, kind of what you were saying, you know, Grace, you find a lot of like-minded people. Twitter has led to collaborations for me. It has allowed me to reach out and discover people's research and papers that I would never found otherwise, or would have been far more difficult for me to find. It's allowed me to find reviewers for papers, to, you know, reviewers to recommend for my own papers. It's found, it's, you know, kind of linked, it's helped me solve problems. I can post something to Twitter and get answers on everything from statistics to methodology to where to find a paper much faster than I can something like Stack Overflow or any other medium. Like, it's an incredibly huge, powerful tool that, you know, I think is only rivaled by Slack. And even then, I don't think Slack comes close to what Twitter does. It's hugely powerful. Is it full of a bunch of crap too? Yeah, it is. But you don't have to do that. And if you don't want to use Twitter and you don't want to use social media, you don't have to. You don't have to do it. Twitter, the problem with Twitter, I think, majorly is, like, if you want it to be a utility, you have to use it a lot. That's how you get the most useful out. You have to integrate it as an integral part of your life. And you don't have to do that if you want to. That's fine. I understand that. But, you know, it's I think it's really powerful, and I really like it. It's a big aspect of my life, and it kind of just sits in the background on my computer all the time. I don't, like, obsess over it or look over it a lot, but it's kind of on, and then I'll check it. And I don't mind that. I don't think it's a bad thing. I think Twitter's, like I said, incredibly powerful. And, you know, is there, like, yeah, we gang up on people a lot, right? Like, everybody's passing around the poster thing. Hell, this whole episode has been stuff from Twitter. Literally this entire episode. So, like, we're not going to be that anti-Twitter on this one. And, you know, Mr. American Studies professor, fine, don't use it. But, like, don't yuck everyone else's yum. Like, no one cares, right? Like, that's the great thing about Twitter. I can post something and no one cares. And if it's stupid, I'm going to get called out on it. And that's good.
Yeah.
Don't post or say... I'm trying not to use the word stupid anymore, but I'm trying to replace ableist language, but it's very difficult, more difficult than I thought. But don't say things that aren't, you know, like, don't do it. Do a better job.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, heck yes, I agree with you. Yay, Twitter. Down with American Studies professors with bad takes. Honestly, a little bit down with the Chronicle of Higher Education, but that might just be a whole nother different, yeah.
Are they trying to upstage science and nature commentaries?
No, only ecology and evolution kind commentaries.
Oh, wait, ecology and evolution has bad commentaries too?
I believe we've talked about a few of them, the Nature Eco Evo. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that one. Okay, yeah, I got you. I thought you were meant, like, the journal Ecology and Evolution had, like...
Oh, no, I know nothing about their commentaries.
Do we need a power ranking of bad commentaries? I don't know.
Probably.
Where this slates in. If it's... This one's pretty bad.
Well, until we figure that power ranking out, thanks for joining us. You can find our podcast on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, and on our website. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram for all of our hot takes, memes, and quips, because that's what we do. And until then, we'll see you next time. Bye.